We were almost there. I could see on the opposite side of the road a great floodlit Stars and Stripes, and beside it, flanking the Waldorf's entrance, a Union Jack. The area in front of the hotel was cordoned off by concrete blocks. Frank pulled up briefly on the corner of East 50th Street to let me out, then eased deftly back into the traffic. I crossed the great expanse of road and went through the Art Deco doors, up the grand marble staircase, and into the Babylonian splendour of the Waldorf's lobby. A loud detonation sounded in Park Avenue. Several guests who were checking in ducked, only to straighten ruefully when the explosion turned into a cannonade of gunning motorcycle engines. From the interior of the hotel, across the immense expanse of the Golden Lobby, came a wedge of security men, Special Branch and Secret Service, with Lang enclosed among them. Behind him walked Amelia and the two secretaries. Lang swept by me, his eyes fixed straight ahead, which was unlike him. Usually he liked to connect with people when he passed them, flash them a smile they'd remember always. As he began descending the staircase, Amelia saw me. "I was just trying to call you," she said as she went by. She didn't break step. "There's been a change of plan. We're flying back to Martha's Vineyard now." Lang, below and ahead of us, had already reached the grand entrance. The bodyguards opened the doors, and we emerged into the tumult of noise and light, the shouts of reporters, the fusillade of camera shutters, the rumble of Harley Davidsons. It was as if someone had rolled back the doors to hell. "And what am I supposed to do?" I asked. "Get into the backup car. I expect Adam will want to talk to you on the plane." In different circumstances, I would have relished that journey, my legs stretched out before me, the Harley Davidsons gliding past us to hold back the traffic. The pale faces of the pedestrians glimpsed through the smoked glass, turning to watch us as we hurtled by. When we reached LaGuardia, a few minutes later, we drove past the terminal building, through an open metal gate and directly onto the tarmac, where a big private jet was being fueled. Lang's limousine swerved to a halt, and he dived through the doorway of the mobile body scanner and up the steps into the Gulf Stream without a backward glance. "He says he has to get back to Ruth," said Amelia, gazing up at the plane. "There's something he needs to talk over with her." Her voice was puzzled. She was almost talking to herself, as if I wasn't there. "Perhaps he's heard something from The Hague," I suggested. "No, it's nothing to do with that. He would have told me." I sat with my back to the cockpit so that I could keep an eye on my client. Amelia was directly opposite him, and as the engine started to whine, it was all I could do not to hurl myself at the door and wrench it open. That flight felt doomed to me from the start. The noise of the engines increased, and we began our charge down the runway. It felt as though we were climbing blindly for a long time in our vulnerable metal tube, but then the gauze fell away and we came up into a bright night. Some time after the plane levelled off, Amelia rose and came down the aisle towards me. "All right," she said, "he's ready to have a word. But go easy on him, okay? He's had a hell of a couple of days." "He and I both," I thought. "Will do," I said. "You haven't got long," she warned. "This flight's only a hop." His eyes were closed, a glass held in his outstretched hand. He had removed his jacket and tie, and eased off his shoes, and was sprawled back in his seat like a starfish. At first, I thought he'd fallen asleep, but then I realized his eyes were narrowed to slits, and he was watching me closely. I sat down and fumbled to pull out my notebook, the mini recorder and a spare tape. And wasn't this what Reichardt wanted? Tapes. "So," he said, "how's it going? Found out anything interesting?" There was a gleam of something in his eyes. Contempt? Amusement? I sensed he was playing with me. This and that. How was Washington? Washington was great, actually. There's a rustling noise as he straightens slightly in his chair, drawing himself up to give one last performance before the theatre closes for the night. I got the most terrific support everywhere. On the Hill, of course, as you probably saw. But also the Vice President and the Secretary of State. They're going to help me in every way they can. And is the bottom line that you'll be able to settle in America? Oh, yes. If the worst comes to the worst, they'll offer me asylum. But it won't get that far. They're going to supply something much more valuable.
Really?
Lang nodded.
Evidence. Is that thing working?
He asked. There is a deafening clunk as I pick up the tape recorder. Yes, I think so. Is that okay? I just want to make sure you get this down, said Lang. He leaned forwards to emphasize his words. Washington is prepared to provide sworn testimony that no United Kingdom personnel were directly involved in the capture of those four men in Pakistan. Really? You bet. The director of the CIA himself will provide a deposition to the court in The Hague, saying that this was an entirely American operation, and if that doesn't do the trick, he's prepared to let the actual officers who were running the mission provide evidence in camera. Lang sat back and sipped his brandy. That should give Reichardt something to think about. How's he going to make a charge of war crimes stick now? But your memorandum to the Ministry of Defence, that's genuine? He conceded with a shrug. It's true. I can't deny that I urged the use of the SAS, and it's true that our special forces were in Peshawar at the time of Operation Tempest. But there's no proof that we passed that intelligence on to the CIA. The men arrested in Peshawar claim they were innocent, I pointed out. Of course they claim they were innocent. What else are they going to say? Lang studied me closely, as if seeing me for the first time. I'm beginning to think you're too naive for this job. Unlike Mike Makara, I said. Mike! Lang laughed and shook his head. Mike was naive in a different way. Is it true you had a serious row with him just before he died? Mike made certain wild accusations. I could hardly ignore them. May I ask what kind of accusations? I could imagine Reichardt and the special prosecutor sitting listening to the tape, straightening in their chairs at that. On the tape, the pause that follows is quite short, but at the time it seemed endless, and Lang's voice, when it came, was deadly quiet. I'd prefer not to repeat them. Were they to do with the CIA? Surely you already know, said Lang bitterly, if you've been to see Paul Emmett. At this time, the pause is as long on the recording as it is in my memory. Delivered of his bombshell, Lang gazed out of the window and sipped his drink. I looked at him and saw that the years had caught up with him at last. I doubt he could have had much sleep for weeks, probably not since Makara had confronted him. When at last he turned back to me, there wasn't anger in his expression, merely a great weariness. I want you to understand, he said, with heavy emphasis, that everything I did, both as party leader and as Prime Minister, I did out of conviction because I believed it was right. I mumbled a reply. Emmett claims you showed him some photographs. May I see? I removed them from the envelope and pushed them across the table towards him. Odd, murmured Lang. Well, we've all changed so much, and yet also stayed exactly the same. He squinted closely at one of the riverbank pictures. It was the girls, I noticed, rather than himself or Emmett, who seemed to fascinate him the most. I remember her, he said, tapping the picture, and her. She wrote to me once when I was Prime Minister. Ruth was not pleased. Oh, God, he said, and passed his hand across his face. Ruth. For a moment, I thought he was about to break down. But when he looked at me, his eyes were dry. What happens next? Is there a procedure in your line of work to deal with this sort of situation? Well, the client always has the last word about what goes in a book, I said. Always. But obviously, in this case, given what happened. On the tape, my voice trails away, and then there is a loud clunk, as Lang leaned forward and grabbed my forearm. If you mean what happened to Mike, then let me tell you, I was absolutely appalled by that. His gaze was fixed on me unwaveringly. He was putting everything he had left into the task of convincing me, and I'll freely confess, despite everything I'd discovered, that he succeeded. To this day, I'm sure he was telling the truth. If you believe nothing else, you must please believe that his death had nothing to do with me, and I shall carry that image of Mike in the morgue until my own dying day. We were coming in low over the treetops. The lights of the Gulf Stream gleamed across dark waves of foliage. I tried to pull my arm away. "Excuse me," I said. Lang reluctantly let go of me, and I fastened my seatbelt. "My God. You've already told someone, haven't you?" I could feel myself turning scarlet. "Who have you told?" Looking out at the dark forest beyond the perimeter of the airport, where anything could be lurking, it seemed like the only insurance policy I had. "Richard Reichardt," I said. Lang must have known then that it was the end of everything. In my mind's eye, I see him still, like one of those once grand but now condemned apartment blocks, moments after the demolition charges have been exploded. For a few seconds, the facade remains bizarrely intact, before slowly beginning to slide. At the front of the plane, the door had opened, and three of the special branch men were disembarking. The pilot had come out of the cockpit to say goodbye, and I saw Lang visibly square his shoulders and advance to meet him, his hand outstretched. "That was great," said Lang vaguely. "As usual, my favourite airline." He shook the pilot's hand, then leaned past him to greet the co-pilot and the waiting steward. "Thanks. Thanks so much." He turned to us, still smiling his professional smile, but it faded fast. He looked stricken. The bodyguard was already halfway down the steps. There was just Amelia, me, and the two secretaries waiting to follow him off the plane. Standing in the lighted glass window of the terminal, I could just make out the figure of Ruth. "Would you mind just hanging back a minute?" he said to Amelia. "And you too," he added to me. "I need to have a private word with my wife." "Is everything all right, Adam?" asked Amelia. "It'll be fine," said Lang. He touched her elbow lightly, then gave us all, including me and the plane crew, a slight bow. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and good night." He ducked through the door and paused at the top of the steps. Amelia and I watched him from the interior of the plane. He was just as he was when I first saw him, searching for an audience with whom he could connect. Even though the windy, floodlit concourse was deserted, apart from the waiting bodyguards, and a ground technician in overalls working late, no doubt eager to get home. Lang must have seen Ruth waiting at the window because he suddenly raised his hand in acknowledgement, then set off down the steps gracefully, like a dancer. He'd gone about 10 yards towards the terminal when the technician shouted out, "Adam!" and waved. The voice was English, and Lang must have recognised the accent of a fellow countryman because he suddenly broke away from his bodyguards and strode towards him, his hand held out. And that was my final image of him. A man always with his hand held out. It is burned onto my retina, his yearning shadow against the expanding ball of bright white fire that suddenly engulfed him. And then there was only the flying debris, the stinging grit, the glass, the furnace heat, and the underwater silence of the explosion.